This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
As I was losing my vision last year, there was one very good question. I expected to lose the ability to read, so what should I do until then? I decided to sit down and put on a blindfold. This was far more practical than perverse. I was going to spend my remaining literacy to learn how to use my computers, gadgets and gizmos with my eyes closed. A painful decision, but one that dramatically demonstrated the problems I'd soon be unable to fix myself. At one point, the deterioration accelerated, and there was every reason to fear I had a couple of weeks before the words left forever. I should have worked even harder, but after just one of those weeks, I gave up. It didn't matter that I was good at technology. All that meant, it seemed, was that I was very good at forgiving it its failings. And the failings in its attempts to work with the blind were worse than any I was used to dealing with before. Digital technology has revolutionised radio and music, creating a near-infinite selection of broadcasts, podcasts and performances on tap. Anything that enhances the ear so much should be a blessing for the blind. Instead, I was cursing it. This was doubly ironic. For the first time in history, we are within sight of having all the information in the world available to everyone over the internet, together with unparalleled abilities to search that information and communicate our ideas to whomever we please. This breaking down the barriers of time and space is especially welcome to anyone who would otherwise find themselves isolated, one of the severest miseries of blindness. I have always been a champion of technology, especially as a playground of the mind. And it's always been good to me in return. So how had it abandoned me at the time of my greatest need? Technology and humans live in a symbiotic relationship. Useful inventions do something for us better than we can do for ourselves. And with each new idea that gives us more power, we adapt to it as the new normal, in the process binding ourselves to the technology while impatiently awaiting the next big thing to restart the cycle. Homo sapiens is really Homo tech. There are aspects of technology that colour its relationship with the blind. Successful technologies appeal to everyone to get the money to make them happen. With information, the most common, most powerful and most easily accessible channel is through the eyes, and thus information technology is primarily visual. And, as I know very well from being one myself, technology is built by engineers who love it just that little bit too much. They are enamoured of its magic, that by combining lifeless chunks of metal, plastic, silicon and software, something new and seemingly alive is created. That fascination and joy of creation tends to override the other side of the symbiotic equation, that ordinary humans actually have to use this stuff. As the hapless rabbi of Prague discovered, the golems we make do not necessarily behave as we would like. My personal golem was certainly not behaving itself. Computers and the visually impaired can work very well together, in theory. A book on paper is utterly fixed. Font size, layout, density of text, and if your eyesight is no good for that, the book is useless. The same book in electronic form can be zoomed, recoloured, refonted, even read aloud, instantly making it accessible. Computers can recognise speech, replacing the keyboard and providing a path onto the internet, and giant screens can be had at very reasonable prices. But this golem has not solved the problem of the ghetto, even while promising that it will. Computers, and information technology in general, are so profoundly visual and change so remarkably quickly that attempts to convert them for those who see badly are falling behind. It's like building aircraft, where some passengers are forced to sit on the wing. That's possible, even exciting, in the days of biplanes, but try doing it on an Airbus at 30,000 feet. Which is what I discovered as I sat frustrated to tears at my darkening screen. I'll pass over the full list of woes, which would be wretched, dull and endless. If you use the internet, you'll know most of them anyway. Web pages with the information you want hidden in a forest of adverts and links. A login that demands you decode some strangely twisted letters to prove you're not a robot. Dancing, twitching pop-up windows that obscure and distract until you click the tiny spot that returns them to the infernal depths from which they crawled. And there are so many more. But if you're sighted, you, unlike me, get the picture. Normally, we mutter and comply. Such things become part of the general rumble of frustration that accompanies information technology, sinking below our awareness. When you cannot see, they are stumbling blocks a mile high that crowd the landscape and cannot be avoided. It is nobody's fault, which is why it has never been fixed. Companies have little motivation to make things any easier for the blind or disadvantaged. There is, they think, no money in it, and mostly they're right. Moreover, making such provision costs them money and carries on costing. Extra complexity with no immediate return is anathema in a fast-changing market. There are companies that do specialise in disabled access, but they find that their best market is in providing software and hardware to other companies that need it to meet legal requirements for that access. Such mandates rarely require the result to be any good, or cheap, or to be designed for the person who actually has to use it. There is a deeper issue. The lifeblood of the modern world is information, and to make money at that, its distribution and use must be artificially limited. Even if you pay for access to something, you must be somehow stopped from making copies that you can then give away. That way lies digital piracy. The computer and the internet, moreover, are infernally efficient copying machines, so entire industries exist to create barriers, technical and legal, to cripple this. Yet all transformative technologies, the stuff that zooms, that speaks, that converts the visual, must of necessity either be designed into everything, or you have to make some form of copy to work with. And if you make copies, how can the provider tell if you're visually impaired or a pirate? The eye patch gives no clue. They can't tell, so close down access to protect their livelihood. Access for someone losing their sight is intrinsically at odds with the primary driving commercial forces of the whole shooting match. No wonder it feels to me like it's broken. But it doesn't have to be like this. For a moment, let's look at the other side of the internet and how it works where there is no limit on copying. To see how, it's important to understand how profoundly weird the internet itself is, not just in what it does, but how it came to be. The internet is unique in that it was never designed as a whole, never commissioned, never built by one company. It's not owned by anyone. It is, in fact, beyond design. Nobody could ever have set out to build what we have today. There is no return on investment at the heart of the internet, at least not one that fits into a balance sheet. Yet it has made plenty of people plenty of money. The internet happened through the dual principles of openness and freedom. The language the internet speaks to itself is a true lingua franca. All the recipes for how it hooks itself up and keeps on running belong to nobody and everybody. The inventors create them in public and give them away to all. This has been very good news for many, especially those whose interests did not perfectly coincide with existing commercial enterprise. The ability to build what you wanted and link it into everything without asking permission or paying rent sparked a revolution. There's more potential. We now have all this available through the smartphone, which comes with us everywhere. This crept into our world disguised as a walkie-talkie. It now reveals itself as a symbiotic second mind of seemingly infinite knowledge, vision and reach. With a little work, it can deliver much of this to broken eyes. It even sucks in the analogue through its camera. Give me half an hour in a room with a book, and I'll take away a copy far more readable to me than the original. You'll even get your book back, something I couldn't have promised in the old days. By taking a picture of each page, a process of a second or so, I create something that could be adjusted perfectly to my remaining visual ability. There's a further trick. Smartphones now can pull the words out of pictures and turn them into ordinary, searchable computer text. I now have a large library of reference books, many too old to exist as e-books, that fits into my hand and needs no catalogue, no index. Moreover, I can extract snippets and send them to correspondents or incorporate them, with proper citations of course, in my own work. It is my personal amanuensis. Blind people have always been able to contribute to culture and creativity, overcoming many disadvantages through tenacity and immense hard work. However, I for one would much rather do so through efficient help than heroics. There really has been no better time to go blind, which makes the commercial limitations on what we can do all the more galling for me, as what I want is access, readable books and text, not piracy. And that brings us back to the nature of copyright itself. We're still discussing what happened the first time technology liberated experience. The arrival of the printing press was the first industrialisation of information and has been blamed for the spread of the Enlightenment, the Reformation, science, unrest among the peasants, and the supremacy of bad literature. This last point, although it may annoy those who would much rather advances in technology should always be morally uplifting or in some way improving, is an important point. You may not want your wives or servants to see anything dubious. But without the stuff we want to see, alongside the things we ought to, we won't get the critical mass that guarantees a universal technology. And it is gratifying that the printing press proved to be something almost impossible to control, although plenty still try. On the back of the printing press came the idea of copyright, a state-granted monopoly that gives the owner of a text the right to control the copies. It has rarely been questioned, seeming as it does to formalise a natural right of ownership and imbue it with a mechanism to make a fair return on one's work. But what the internet has done, both by existing at all and through its own profitable genesis entirely outside such protection, is show that the idea of copyright is open to debate. If it is hard mechanically to make a record or a film or a book, then those who make them can set their own rules for how they're sold. If the physical transference of information is hard, then those who control the distribution can make their own rules too. From these simple observations, most of the popular culture of the 20th century has been harnessed to create huge commercial empires, justified by copyright, but finding it easy to enforce that copyright through the mechanics of copying. Now that the physics works against them, removing all barriers to copying and transfer, the commercial empires have reacted by enforcing copyright more fiercely, even as the limitations that made that enforcement possible have gone away. I've experienced this at first hand, where an electronic book I bought and paid for online, in the service of writing a book myself, could only be displayed in one particular program in ways I could not read, to prevent, of course, people from copying and reselling it. I managed, through consulting the internet from whom no secrets are hid, to eventually extract the text through technical means and read it as I willed. I would much rather not have had to do that. Aside from the inconvenience and frustration, it technically put me in breach of contract with the publisher. And the same is true when I capture a book with my smartphone. These acts of removing a technical barrier to content may soon be criminal if new international trade agreements designed to strengthen and extend copyright protection come to pass as intended. The fact that such measures are thought necessary, alongside the parallel governmental edicts that this or that website should be blocked to dissuade terrible crimes, shows how much potential the internet has to let everyone, including those of dubious motive or bad eyesight, read whatever they like. There are, fortunately, legal rights for the visually impaired to be given equal access to information. These have recently been successfully used in court to allow companies to digitise books in quantity, regardless of copyright. But there's a big difference between a legal right and actually being able to do what I need to do to read a book. And it would be ironic indeed if, despite all these problems, the visually impaired get better and more useful access to the world's information than the sighted can hope for, if I'm allowed a self-built Library of Alexandria in my pocket, serviced by infinitely patient librarians, but you, the sighted, are not. Moreover, as the epitaph puts it, "Stop, ye travellers, as you pass by, as you are now, so once was I, as I am now, so shall you be. Prepare yourself to follow me." With luck, we will all enjoy a much longer lifetime than our ancestors, but the infirmities of age will not be denied. 8 out of 10 people with bad eyesight are over 65. It's a fate awaiting many. It will be cruel indeed when we can build a world so much more amenable to the dulled senses of age if we deny ourselves the right to do so. It will be a crime to blindfold ourselves to what we could do.